All right. Oye, oye, oye. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Allen, and with me this morning are my colleagues Judge Meredith and Judge Toth. We are here in a hybrid proceeding.
This meeting is being streamed.
Excellent. The meeting is being streamed, I'm told. We are here this morning in a hybrid proceeding with the judges here in the courtroom in Washington, D.C., and counsel remote, to hear argument in the matter of Jimmy C. Bonds v. Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 20-4899. Will counsel, beginning with appellate's counsel, please state your appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sandra Booth, appearing for the appellant, Jimmy Bonds.
Thank you, Ms. Booth.
Good morning, Your Honors. Omar Youssef for the Secretary, and with me, second chair is Sarah Fasina.
Good morning to both of you. Ms. Booth, I understand that you would like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Yes, please, 10 minutes. Yep.
Thank you, and so we'll make that, you want to reserve 10 minutes, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, I had been told 5, but we'll give you 10. So with that, you can begin when you're ready, Ms. Booth.
The issue before the court today is a narrow one. It's whether the board erred in holding that the sympathetic reading rule does not apply to pro se veterans who file a claim asserting one theory, whereas the claim is later granted on a different theory. That should be set aside as not in accordance with law, and that Mr. Bond's case should be remanded for a new decision by the board on his earlier effective date claim, which takes into consideration the benefit of the sympathetic reading rule. If I may very quickly review the facts that are relevant to the sympathetic reading issue. Mr. Bonds was discharged honorably from the Navy in 1995. Within 1 year, he was diagnosed with diabetes and was insulin dependent. In 1998, he was diagnosed with secondary peripheral neuropathy. In 1999, he commenced treating with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and who has been his exclusive medical treatment provider at all times since then. In 2011, Mr. Bonds developed a foot infection, and that the treatment of that diabetic foot infection eventually led to a series of 3 amputations of his lower right extremity. In 2013, he filed a claim for compensation for the right lower extremity amputation and secondary depression, asserting that VA physicians had inappropriately treated him in light of his diabetic condition. The regional office denied that claim and he appealed. He was pro se at that time. In 2016, he consulted with counsel. He filed an intent to file claim form. And in 2017, he filed a claim which sought direct service connection on a presumptive theory based on the 1 year rule. That claim was granted, as were secondary claims for a myriad of what are extremely disabling diabetic residuals in his case. All of those claims were awarded effective 2016, consistent with the intent to file claim form. Mr. Bonds claims or contends that he is entitled to an effective date of 2013, that under the sympathetic reading rule, the claim, his 2013 claim, and the evidence that was before the agency then and has been added to the file in connection with the development of that claim.
Counsel, I have a question.
Yes.
To what extent does the fact that Mr. Bonds was not represented in 2013 when he filed his 1151 claim. To what extent does that sort of play into your theory of relief? I mean, is it dispositive? Is it one factor among many?
I think how
should we consider the pro se aspect?
I think the fact that he was pro se in 2013 has been deemed by a variety of court decisions from this court and the Federal Circuit to be critical to the question of whether his claim should be sympathetically pled or sympathetically read, even though he did not plead it with particularity. So it is one of the
Ms. Booth, I want to follow up if I can on Judge Toth's question. So a little bit of a follow up. It seems to me though that it's hard to see this as something where we can fault VA for going down the path it did when, for example, during the hearing, the board hearing, where he had a VSO representative, and I understand that's still treated as pro se for all intents and purposes. This isn't a situation where we now look and we say, hey, board, you should have gone down this path. This is almost a situation in which at the hearing, there was reiteration that, no, the path we're going down is 1151. The diabetes references during that hearing were all connected with why VA's medical care was claimed to being inadequate. In other words, I'm a diabetic, and so the treatment you gave me for this injury should have been different than it was. It seems to me the sympathetic reading doctrine doesn't require that we ignore basically what the veteran's theory of the case is to make something else up. So if you could respond to that, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly, Your Honor. The sympathetic reading rule restricts VA from a restrictive reading to identify the benefit sought. That requirement requires VA to determine all potential claims, reviewing not just the four corners of the veteran's claim document, but also all evidence and apply all relevant laws and regulations. Now, at the time that he filed this claim, VA medical records over a period of years related his history of an onset of diabetes mellitus within 1 year of discharge. One of the very, very purpose of the sympathetic reading rule is that the VA must presume that the veteran does not understand all the intricacies of VA law and may not know the technical requirements of VA law, may be unaware of a different theory that would support his claim. That's exactly what Mr. Bond's situation is. While he did focus on the 1151 aspect, during the pendency of this claim, the 1151 claim, which remains pending to this day, it has never become final, the evidence that the VA had before it included, you know, the references throughout the medical treatment records of his history of an 1996 onset of manifestation of diabetes. And also during the pendency of this claim, he added those medical records which substantiated the 1996 diagnosis. In fact, that is the very basis upon which VA granted service connection on a presumptive theory and consequently granted second service connection. So, that, I think, brings the claim within the Delisio case, where the veteran filed a claim for leg numbness and peripheral neuropathy. Those claims remained pending when he clarified his claim and filed for direct service connection of diabetes based on early diabetes.
But Ms. Booth, in terms of Delisio, and also in terms of Shea, you haven't mentioned Shea, but your reference to Four Corners, I'm assuming, referred to the Federal Circuit's decision in Shea. Both of those are different. Now, that's not dispositive of how this comes out, but The benefit, so a Section 1151 benefit is different than a service-connected benefit. So in Shea, for example, it was the veteran listed physical conditions referred to a medical record, and if you went to the medical record, it had a psychiatric condition. But all of those benefits, whether they were for physical or mental, were service connection compensation benefits. Same thing in Delisio, right? Here, though, we have something different, which is the benefit claimed was a medical malpractice for all intents and benefits, 1151, which the law is clear is not a service-connected benefit. It will be treated as if it were in some situations, but it's not. And so how do we apply Shea and Delisio in that particular context when, in fact, the veteran is claiming different benefits, literally different types of benefits?
Your Honor, I would not agree that the benefit itself is different. Under Section 1151, and this is the language which the Secretary's brief relies on, it provides that the compensation under 1151 or the compensation shall be awarded for qualifying additional disability or death of the veteran in the same manner as if such additional disability or death were service-connected. That language, consequently, is not triggered. It doesn't even apply until the VA has already made a determination that an award under Section 1151 is warranted. And then the effect of that language is that it controls on downstream elements, downstream issues related to ancillary benefits. It has nothing to do. It doesn't even have any meaning until that award is first determined to be warranted. So it does not, in my view, limit any of the fiduciary's responsibility.
Could I just follow up on that? Sure. So let's take Delisio for a second, okay? So the Delisio rule, as Delisio articulates it, is I file a claim for X. It turns out that I'm seeking service connection for X. It turns out during the course of adjudicating service connection for X, VA finds out, oh my goodness, X is actually caused by Y, and Y turns out to be a primary condition that is related to service. And so Delisio basically says, if you file for a secondary condition, you find out that a primary condition actually causes the secondary condition, and the primary condition is itself related to service, then you sort of put the whole thing together. So are you on the same page with me about that, basically the Delisio rule?
Yes, yes.
So here's my problem with Delisio in this context. The claim before VA, which would be equivalent in the Delisio world to what turns out to be the secondary claim, okay? The one that's filed is an 1151 claim, which requires that you have to show deficient medical care from VA or lack of notice, informed consent, right? That's the thing. How would Delisio apply to say that you find a primary condition that caused the secondary condition in the way that Delisio talks about? Because here, the diabetes didn't cause the medical malpractice, right? You see what I'm struggling with on that?
I see what you're saying, Your Honor. However, I have a different take on it. Veterans don't file claims for service connection. They don't file claims for as if service connected. They file claims for compensation. The 1151, the 1110, those are all theories, pathways by which the veteran can get to the entitlement to compensation. Mr. Bond's 2013 claim sought compensation for his amputation. His claim clearly relates that to the residuals of his diabetic infection, relates the need for the amputation to his diabetic infection. his theory of the case was that VA had not appropriately treated him in light of his diabetes. To me, I think that the fact that he pled the wrong theory does not, under the sympathetic reading rule, deprive him of the benefit of having VA adjudicated, have the expertise, and know what the VA legal requirements are, from looking at that issue and saying, does the claim, does the evidence otherwise support a different theory? And in this case, it did. I also think it's significant in this case, number one, that his filing, he has raised an issue about a decision which is subject to presumptive service action. In my view, any time a veteran asserts a claim, which is a preferred condition that is subject to presumptive service connection, that should immediately alert does he have the elements that are that would qualify him for presumptive service connection? Because if he does, then the claim is done and he's entitled to the support he saw.
Can I jump in there? I want to talk to you about the content of the original claim that was filed in 2013, if I could. So in one of the documents that the appellant filed back in 2013 included his statements outlining the medical treatment that you're talking about, of the wound of the foot, the diabetes causing infection eventually led to the amputation. And in that statement, he refers specifically to the VA medical records that reflect that treatment and says, please review these records in support of my claim. So in terms of VA deciding what was the scope of that initial claim, should they have looked specifically at those records and maybe noticed that there were references to diabetes and references to diabetes within 1 year after service?
I would say that yes, they did, having been directed to the medical records, because the medical records laid out that theory, laid out the basis for a presumptive service connection theory. So yes, I would agree that they should. I also think it's relevant, Your Honor, that there is no temporal requirement, at least the court has never imposed one, on when this additional evidence is submitted. For example, in Delicio, the original claim, which was asserted for residual conditions of diabetes, was filed, I think, in 1986, whatever the year. The actual claim for diabetes was filed several years later. What was relevant to the sympathetic reading requirement that would support an earlier effective date was not what was in the record at the time he filed the claim, but rather the fact that that evidence was added and that theory was clarified while that original claim was still pending.
So here the board didn't discuss these medical records of the treatment and that there was references to diabetes and that contributing to the condition. What can we take from those records? Is that something, does that require board findings in the first instance to look at whether the initial claim documents actually encompassed a claim, an informal claim for diabetes?
My initial view, and I think as we briefed, was that the court should reverse on the question of whether or not he had an informal claim, whether the diabetes claim was encompassed in the 2013 claim. In preparation for argument, I think that is a reach. I think that the only issue before the court in this case is a much narrower one, and that is whether the board erred in finding that the sympathetic reading doctrine is not even applicable. The appropriate relief, in my view, is that finding is set aside as not in accordance with law, and that the effective date issue be remanded for the board to make the initial findings of fact in light of the settlement.
So you've asked us to look at the, as Judge Elm is talking about, the Delisio test, which basically talks about the appellant didn't need to file a claim for that intermediate causal condition because it was a necessary step in adjudicating the condition that was claimed. So here, it's possible that the appellant's initial claim stating documents did encompass an informal claim for diabetes. Is it premature? Do we need to get to the question of whether the claim could have been reasonably raised or encompassed within other claims? In what order do we decide that? If there's an actual claim, do we need to get to those questions of reasonably raised or encompassed?
I think the board, I don't think the court can get to that in this case because the board has never made a decision on it. The board denied the earlier effective date, but it simply didn't apply the sympathetic reading rule. The reason it stated it was not absent is contrary to law, in my view. So I don't think this court at this juncture in the case can go farther than that, except to say that the board erred in declining to apply the sympathetic reading rule, and that the case was then remanded for the board to make those findings.
Ms. Booth, your time is coming to an end, but I'll give you a little bit extra here so I can ask this question, which is, I understand your theory of the case as you're framing it. You are driving it home, as you did in your brief, sympathetic reading, sympathetic reading, sympathetic reading. I'll tell you, I'm not quite sure that's the right frame. I will tell you to tip my hands, I am not persuaded by the Delisio argument at all in this context, if we were to reach it. But what I am intrigued about is the argument that Judge Meredith was questioning you on. And I want to make sure that when you keep saying to us sympathetic reading, you're actually thinking of this same thing. We have Shea and Sellers from the Federal Circuit, which clearly make clear that in some situations, you look at the claim document itself and you might look somewhere else to look for something that in some situations will point to the fact that a claim has been made, and in some situations will point to a fact that they aren't. So what I'd like you to think about, and you can respond on rebuttal, right, is that I see this case as coming in between Shea and Sellers. And I'll just lay out what, so you can respond. As I read Shea, the veteran claims certain physical conditions relating to a particular event and refers to the medical records associated with that event. You then, I'm shortening this, but you go to those medical records that talk about the physical conditions, but also talk about a psychological condition related to the same event that encompassed the physical conditions. So the Federal Circuit says, that's sufficient to establish a claim. Sellers is a situation where you make a veteran files a claim document that refers to certain things and then refers to medical records. You go to the medical records and they show a diagnosis of another condition. In that case, the Federal Circuit said that's not enough. Right. This seems to me to be sort of a hybrid of the two, because it isn't as clear to me as Shea that we're talking about a single event that you go to the medical records and you see diagnosis of diabetes. But it's also not like Sellers, because it's not just totally independent. And so how do we figure out which of those two rules is most applicable here, whether we call it sympathetic reading or not? Or do we just send it back to the board because the board didn't really totally consider all of that a point. Do you have any thoughts on that?
The Sellers case, I think, is the distinction that the Federal Circuit made, at any rate, was that the veteran had pled so generally that the claim that he contended was subject to having been, to being encompassed, the condition that he claimed was encompassed within that claim, Sellers held it, the condition itself has to be identified in some way. In that case, I believe he pled that he wanted service connection for all conditions. It was very generic, all conditions that might be supported by the record or some similar language. That's where.
Yes, it was all conditions shown in my service medical records.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Something almost exactly for that. He claimed one thing. And then what our court held was we look to the medical records that he identified, his service medical records, and if there's a diagnosis, VA is required to consider that as having been a claim. And the Federal Circuit said no. So that isn't precisely your case. I agree with you, right? But in a way it is, because you've asserted an 1151 claim which requires this looking for negligence. But the medical records to which we're directed shows a diagnosis of diabetes, right? But they're not necessarily connected.
The diagnosis of diabetes is reported by the veteran's history as manifesting within 1 year of his discharge. That is what immediately should trigger for the VA the issue of whether, regardless of whether there is an 1151 issue, is he entitled to presumptive service connection under the one-year rule? That didn't happen. That's what should have happened. His claim is further differentiated from Sellers because the diabetes is identified within the 1151 claim that the amputation, which he sought compensation for, was due to his diabetic infection, but it was that diabetic infection which he claimed, asserted that VA providers had not appropriately treated. So in my view, applying the sympathetic reading rule, and I understand that the court has some reservations about use of that phrase without clarification, but those facts hit all the markers for the sympathetic reading rule. The veteran was pro se at the time he asserted it, asserted the 1151 theory. He clearly related his condition, the amputation, to his diabetic condition, and the evidence then before VA showed that he was diagnosed with diabetes within the presumptive period. Now, in addition, to get back very quickly to a thought I had earlier and got sidetracked from, I would note that there is no temporal requirement on when that evidence that supports the alternate theory must be submitted, so long as the original claim remains pending. In this case, it was. The 2013 claim is still pending. It's before the board for a new decision after gone through several remands. During the pendency of that 2013 claim, which asserted an 1151 theory to support an award of compensation, he submitted the 2017 claim, which specifically requested presumptive service connection, and submitted copies of the original medical records showing the diagnosis within 1 year. Those factors read together support that the 2013 claim, sympathetically read, as the court has construed in Delisio, encompassed the claim for direct service connection based on presumptive theory. Does that respond, Your Honor?
It does. I'm just going to check with my colleagues to see, Judge Meredith, do you have any questions?
I have one follow-up question on a conversation you were having with Judge Allen about Delisio. As we talked about a minute ago, Delisio basically said you don't have to file a claim for that intermediate step, the cause in between service and what you'd actually claimed. Here, so in deciding to claim Delisio, VA could not do that without addressing that intermediate step. But here, VA could have adjudicated the 1151 claim without deciding the etiology of diabetes. They didn't have to talk about that to figure out whether there was malpractice in the amputation. So how is that legally, in your view, the same, that it would excuse the filing of an 1110 claim where all he had filed was an 1151? Because it wasn't a necessary element to figure out whether diabetes was service-connected.
I'm not sure I understand the distinction you're making there, Judge Meredith.
The causal condition was a necessary step in adjudicating the claimed condition. Here, it was not a necessary step in the 1151 claim to figure out the etiology of diabetes. So why does filing that 1151 claim excuse you, as in Delisio? They didn't have to file a claim for the other condition. How does that work here when it's not a necessary step in the claim that you did file? It's an entirely separate matter.
Well, the rule under Delisio, as I read it, is that evidence where a veteran claims a condition that is not directly related to service, but during the development of that claim, there is evidence developed or obtained which shows that there is a cause of that condition which may well be related to service. In that circumstance, that's Delisio holds, the causal condition is a part of the original claim. I'm not sure I see the distinction. I don't think the distinction that.
So the part of Delisio that I'm focusing on is that it excuses you from filing a claim for the unclaimed condition. So here, diabetes. But the reason Delisio did that was because you couldn't adjudicate the claim that was filed without talking about the intermediate step of what caused the neuropathy. We don't have that situation here. VA didn't need to talk about diabetes in order to address the 1151 claim. That's the distinction I was trying to get you to address, is why does that excuse you from filing the claim that wasn't necessary to the only claim that you did file? But I'll turn it back to it.
So I have sort of a variation on the same question, which is, I mean, it strikes me from your argument that at least for pro se claimants, that virtually every 1151 claim could be repurposed as something like a secondary service connection claim, right? Because you would have a veteran and they'd be receiving treatment from a VA facility, and 1151 would look into whether you have an additional disability, and that additional disability would naturally presume that there might be it might derive from an earlier disability to which it's related. There's a causal relationship. And so it struck me that VA's duty under your argument would encompass in almost every 1151 case to look into whether the additional disability isn't, in a sense, a secondarily service-connected disability. And so that's I think I see 1151, like to Judge Meredith's point, kind of dispenses with one element, which is you don't have to sort of prove the primary service connection. You can just look at whether this additional disability will treat it as if it's service connected. My point is this, my question is this, what's the limiting principle, or what are the limiting factors in your argument that make this not the case, where every 1151 claim would at least raise the specter of also a theory of service connection? I mean, for instance, if you raised, you know, if you mentioned he was in college, would they have to look into like a GI Bill or something? Would they have to look into education benefits or something? Like, what's the limit of the scope of the claim in light of your theory?
The scope of the claim will be limited by, number one, the condition that's identified in the veteran's claim documents, a review of the evidence and an application of relevant law. Not every Section 1151 claim, in fact, in my experience, most of them, do not relate back to a disability that is service, that is, was incurred in service or could be related to service. So I think it has to be reasonably apparent from a review of the evidence of record, the evidence developed in connection with the claim and the condition identified by the veteran, whether or not VA needs to go back further and take a deeper dive. I don't think that the character of an 1151 claim expands the scope of the secretary's duty. The question is more, what is the nature of that condition? What caused that condition?
Okay, so I know you sort of touched around the edges of this question. I want to go back to Delisio, right? So that case talks about, you know, causal disabilities and whether one disability sort of reasonably encompasses another. And I want to ask, so how in light of Delisio should, like, what should the adjudicator have done? What's the first step is basically identify diabetes, and then how does that relate to the claim and the evidence that's in front of the adjudicator? Like, walk through the steps just to show how apparent all of this should have been to the adjudicator.
Once the veteran asserted a claim for his amputation, which he related back to the diabetic infection, and the medical records themselves relate back, relate a history of diagnosis of diabetes within 1 year, that triggers the VA's responsibility, the VA's duty to consider relevant law, which it would include 307 and 309 regarding the 1 year manifestation provision regarding diabetes. So that would be one. Number two would be that during the pendency of this claim, Mr. Bonds.
And just to slow you down for a second, excuse me. So for instance, like, would the years that he served be relevant in an 1151 claim? Like, would they even know that he got out of service in 1996 and that he had a diagnosis later in 1996 so that it, you know, the presumptive piece would be relevant? Because normally in 1151, I mean, when you served isn't relevant. It's just that you have veteran status.
The date of discharge is always going to be in the claim file because it's relevant to establishing veteran status. So the VA would know that because it's disclosed through through the claim file, or through the filing of the claim itself. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
The Delisio steps, again, so step one, identify diabetes in the evidence. Step two, just walk through what should the adjudicator sort of conceptually have noticed?
Step two would be, and I think this would apply to any condition that is subject to presumptive service connection, that the VA would then look at whether or not there is a relevant law that would support service connection for that that condition without having to go down the road of developing the claim. Is there a presumptive basis for service connection? Does the veteran's claim tick off all those criteria? If it does, then service connection would be granted automatically without the need to even review and do the rather intense development that's associated with an 1151 claim. I think the same thing would apply, for example, if a Vietnam veteran filed a claim for lung cancer and asserted medical negligence in delayed diagnosis. If I were a VA adjudicator, I would immediately say, what did he serve in Vietnam? Did he have herbicide exposure? Grant the claim on that presumptive basis. And that effectively moots out the 1151 issue.
Okay, that's what I meant earlier about the 1151 claims being sort of encompassed within kind of a secondary claim. But thank you. You answered my questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And could I just ask one more before the end, and we'll give Mr. Youssef plenty of time if he needs it. So I just want to, following up on Judge Toth's point about the limits of your argument, does your argument about reading the claim that your client submitted back in 2013, okay, does it depend on the fact that there is a potential connection between the condition at issue, the amputation, and diabetes? Let me just change it. Assume that the claim he files is, he says, I'm seeking benefits under Section 1151 because I had an elective surgery mole removal, and my informed consent was not given appropriately. Doesn't say anything about diabetes, but he includes exactly the same phrase at the end, which is, my health care was provided through the VAMC in Columbus, Ohio, and Dayton, Ohio. Please review these records in support of my claim. And those records include a diagnosis of diabetes within 1 year of leaving service. Would your argument then say VA needed to adjudicate the claim for diabetes because he refers to the medical records that includes a diagnosis of diabetes? Or does your claim require that there be some more of a nexus between the 1151 claim and this other condition that is referred to in the medical records?
In your hypothetical, Your Honor, where he has residual injury due to a mole removal, I would say, applying the sympathetic reading rule, that doesn't reasonably lead to the question, that doesn't sufficiently identify the condition under Sellers or under Shea that would be sufficient to lead the VA to understand or appreciate that he really wants service connection for diabetes. There is, in my view, I think it's a highly factual question, it's an intensely factual question. In my view, though, I don't see where the potential connection between diabetes and the removal of a mole. That's not apparent to me on that hypothetical.
So then, because what we're going to do, somebody's going to write an opinion that then, if we adopt your view, has to give guidance to the agency writ large about what they're supposed to do when they get an 1151 claim, right? And so it's not then enough that one can just look at the medical record, know that he identifies in the claim, know that the veteran served in Vietnam, knows that he had the condition within 1 year of service, and so therefore it's presumptively connected. That's not enough under your view, even though the 1151 claim in my hypothetical for the mole removal, right, directs you to the medical records. There has to be something in the claim document itself that has some level of connection. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Well, what I'm missing, not exactly, Your Honor, but what I'm missing in your hypothetical is where VA might reasonably have looked at the record, looked at the law, and concluded that there was a connection between an unclaimed condition, diabetes, and the condition for which he's seeking compensation, the mole removal residuals. That's not the situation in Mr. Bond's case. He filed for compensation for his leg amputation related, and he identifies it as related to and the medical records identify it as related to treatment for his diabetic infection. And the records show that he had an onset of diabetes within 1 year of the date of discharge. That's where I see the steps. There was an identification of diabetes, which is a presumptive condition, and there was evidence that he met the presumptive requirements. And it's undisputed that that diabetes was the cause of the infection, which ultimately led to the amputation. So I don't think we're breaking new ground, that it just falls back on what the court has decided are the parameters of the sympathetic reading rule in the past, including under Delisio.
Judge Merritt, do you have anything else? Judge Toth? Well, thank you, Ms. Booth. We will restore your full rebuttal time because we took you over with our questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Youssef?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The central issue in this case is whether claims under 38 U.S.C. 1110 and claims under 38 U.S.C. 1151 are separate and distinct claims, as this court has explained in Anderson. The answer can only be yes. Specifically, the court should affirm the board's decision that properly denied entitlement to an earlier effective date because the board adequately addressed the arguments that appellant raises here. Thus, the court should reject these same arguments for two reasons. First, the case law, most notably Anderson, which we submit is controlling, already explains that 1110 and 1151 are separate and distinct legal claims, such that the 1151 claim in 2013 could not have encompassed an 1110 claim. And second, as the board plausibly found, even when read sympathetically, the 2013 claim did not indicate an intent to apply for benefits for diabetes, but at least a high level of generality. As to the first point, Your Honors, there is a well-settled legal distinction between an 1110...
Counsel, so on your first point, does the agency need there to be a hard barrier between 1151 and 1110 claims to prevail here? Or is it possible that some 1150 some pleadings of facts could reasonably raise a service connection theory within an 1151? So I guess my question is, do you need to win on the first? Or is the first, you know, can it be merely a very strong factor as it relates to, you know, how we judge the scope of a claim?
So, Your Honors, I think our position is generally that it's a hard line because there are different legal and evidentiary requirements that are required for 1110 and 1151 claims. So, for example, 1110 requires the elements of service connection, whereas 1151 requires an analysis of negligence or medical malfeasance by the agency. We also, you know, submit that those are two different types of claims that result in two different types of statuses or benefits. So 1151, you know, I would respectfully disagree with my colleague here. 1151 does not accord service-connected status. The courts explained that the veteran is compensated as if they're service-connected, but we don't think that that's equitable or the same as being service-connected. We would also submit that the ancillary benefits are different between the two, between 1110 and 1151 status. And even, Your Honors, the duty to assist, the types of medical opinions that the agency would seek in adjudicating and developing the claims would be different, and they would be analyzing different, the different elements that apply to each type of claim. So generally, Your Honor, we think that there is a hard line, but because it is often a fact-intensive inquiry, we could also envision a claim where the context and what the veteran says could raise both. But respectfully, we submit that that's not the issue here. Your Honor, just to go back to the point about Anderson, the court held specifically in that case that there is a legal distinction between filing a claim for service connection under 1110 and a claim for compensation under 1151. And in that case, they noted that while the claimant had an 1110 claim that was pending, quote, any claim for compensation based upon his award of compensation for impotence pursuant to 1151 constitutes a separate and distinct claim for benefits, and that a claim under Section 1151 is not, properly speaking, a claim for service connection pursuant to 1151. So, Your Honor, the court has already explained that these are two separate and distinct legal claims, and that a claimant may have such two distinct claims for the same condition, which they've already established. So based on this, Your Honors, the board properly found that an ambiguous claim for one may not encompass the other because the nature, again, of the claims are different. The legal standards, the evidentiary requirements, and even the benefits that are accorded to the recipients of each. Based on that, Your Honors, the 2013 claim for 1151 benefits could not have included a claim for 1110 because, again, they're separate and distinct claims. And even looking at the context of the 2013 claim itself, the appellant clearly identified that he was only seeking 1151 benefits. He referenced the reasonable care or the lack of reasonable care. And, Your Honors, even if we look beyond that, the subsequent procedural history for the next 3 years was focused on 1151 and the treatment or the lack of proper treatment that was provided by the agency, to include, as Your Honor noted earlier, the hearing testimony in which the veteran reiterated that the issue was the lack of proper treatment at VA. So we think that even so within the fact intensive inquiry, which would vary from case to case here, Your Honors, the claim itself relates back to 1151, and there's no reasonable indication that the veteran was seeking service connection or benefits generally for diabetes. Your Honors, adopting...
I have a question I want to ask. So does the change in the regulation about how forms are filed, claims are filed, I think it was 2017 that the reg was changed requiring a specific form, is that relevant at all? I mean, this type of informal claim would not now be deemed proper because VA would have just sent the form and said, fill out the proper form. So is the change in reg relevant at all towards your position?
I think, Your Honor, we would point you to the courts or the Federal Circuit's holding in Sellers, where the Federal Circuit said that the correct test is whether the formal claim requires an or. With the court, Federal Circuit held that the correct test requires an identification of the benefits to a high level of generality. But then they followed that up immediately by stating that this is the same test that they've applied in evaluating the sufficiency of informal claims, and they cited to Shea. So we think that the test applies to both formal and informal claims. Furthermore, Your Honors, adopting the appellant's argument here, and I think this was touched on a bit, but it would essentially eviscerate the need for that general level of intent. It would possibly erase finality with the possibility that claims could remain open in perpetuity with an 1110 claim encompassing 1151 or other types of claims. And quite honestly, it would require the agency to engage in prognostication and attempt to read the mind of the claimant and figure out what potential claims he or she may be seeking and seeking benefits here. So, Your Honors, we think that the distinction here between 1110 and 1151 is critical. We would also agree, Your Honors, with the distinction that was discussed about Delisio. That case dealt with one claim reasonably encompassing the other under the same legal umbrella. So both of those were 1110 claims. Here, the sympathetic reading requirement we submit can't traverse and encompass a different claim. So it can't, the 1151 claim cannot reasonably encompass an 1110 claim without sufficient indication or intent provided in the claim itself. And because the...
Mr. Youssef, before you get too far down the road into Delisio, can I bring you back to my little hobby horse today, which is Shea and Sellers, okay? Which is there, in your view, is there any situation where the sort of Shea reasoning can apply such that a claim is made formally for an 1151 issue. It refers to medical records that lead to some diagnoses in the medical record, okay? Is there any situation in which you think it would be possible that Shea would suggest that having made an 1151 claim, you could find an 1110 claim by going beyond the four corners in the same way that Shea did? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I do, Your Honor. So if I properly, I guess, get your question, it's that if a veteran files an 1151 claim, is there anything beyond the four corners that could raise an 11 or encompass an 1110 claim?
Right. Right. Under sort of the logic of Shea that you're looking somewhere else and you see something else. Or is it that the Anderson approach that you have articulated is really a hard, fast stop, which is 1151 is one form of benefit. So the Shea idea of looking somewhere else, just you never really get there, because unless it identified an 1151 claim in this other thing, you're traversing one benefit to another.
Yes, Your Honor. So our position is that, you know, you can't traverse it. The Anderson distinction would be dispositive in that regard, because Shea dealt with 1110 benefits, and, you know, we certainly abide by that. And if that was the issue here, you know, we wouldn't be here. But the 1110 and 1151 distinction is dispositive here, so we can't. This doesn't get to Shea, Your Honors, respectfully, is essentially what we're saying, because of that distinction.
So a follow-up that's more of a practical nature than a necessarily legal nature. So as I said to Ms. Booth, and as you know, you've appeared here a lot, we're going to end up then writing an opinion. Some one of us is going to write an opinion that's going to be talking about, you know, 1151 versus 1110 and you know, how it applies with Shea and Sellers and all of that type of stuff. And no matter how hard we try to narrowly write that opinion, it's going to be one that then is going to be, you know, something that the agency has to wrestle with one way or the other, no matter how it comes out. The reason I start out with that is, this is, when I saw this case, this is weird in the sense that it's a situation in which somebody does assert a claim directly for 1151. It says that, and I agree with you, as I said to Ms. Booth, in the course of the proceedings, we keep hammering on 1151. But the oddity is, always in the background is the reference to this condition that now is subject to 1110, right? It's not as if it's like way off in outer space and you'd say, how could VA ever figure it out, right?
Right.
And to make it even more complicated, it's this presumptive condition, because the records clearly show it's within 1 year of leaving service. My point is, has the agency given any consideration that these facts are just really weird facts to be then making, extrapolating out to a very broad rule here?
You know, I certainly understand the concern there, because I appreciate the notation to diabetes and pointing to the record of the diagnoses within a year of service connection, or within a year of separation from service. I think, though, when it comes to the case, you know, I think just as a general kind of a holding, you know, I think we would essentially ask the court to affirm or reiterate that the 1110 and 1151 claims are separate and distinct because of the distinctions and, you know, the variances that have been discussed, and that while the agency is required to read pleadings sympathetically, we certainly don't contest that. And that's something I'll try to touch on as well. The claimants are still required to identify the benefit to a high level of generality. So really, we're just asking the court to affirm the existing case law and reiterate that here. So to Your Honor, to touch on that second point, You know, I think respectfully, we would disagree again that the board didn't carve out an exception to the sympathetic reading requirement. The board actually didn't make that finding. The board actually noted that it has a duty to essentially read pleading sympathetically, but it based its denial on the fact that the sympathetic reading doctrine still mandates some level of intent, at least a high level of generality. It's certainly lessened. That requirement is certainly lessened, especially if the claimant is pro se. But there still has to be that level of generality that has been espoused by the court and by the Federal Circuit. So, you know, the doctrine has its limitations, Your Honors, which for one are intention. You know, the courts explained that intention is the cornerstone of any claim, and that's either formal or informal. And the doctrine also doesn't require VA to anticipate claims that haven't been identified yet, or to, engage in prognostication about what the claimant may be seeking, again, to that reasonable extent. The doctrine only requires VA to consider all claims that are reasonably raised by the evidence. So the inquiry, Your Honor, is whether the board acted reasonably under the circumstances. And in this case, we submit that it did, based on the context of the September 2013 claim, the ensuing procedural history that continued for 3 years, and the context in general of what the claimant was seeking. So the board's findings in this regard, Your Honors, are consistent with the established case law about the sympathetic reading requirement and the distinction between 1110 and 1151 claims. And in that, within that framework.
Sorry, finish your thought and then I'll jump in.
Your Honor, I was just going to say that within that framework, we submit that the board's findings were adequate.
So following up on your conversation about if it was an 1151 claim, it seems like you're saying VA may never have an obligation to sympathetically or reasonably look into whether it could also encompass an 1110 claim. Is that your position?
I think, Your Honor, the position is that it can't do that because of the distinction. If it was, again, a reasonable indication within the claim itself, then certainly VA would be obligated to do that. But in a situation like this, where the context of the claim, the statement, the accompanying statement, you know, looking beyond that into the procedural history, everything is pointing to 1151, Your Honors. VA was not required to look beyond that and consider an 1110 claim. And so, as Judge Toth noted earlier, there would be no need, for example, to look at the veteran's service for an 1151 claim. So while the diagnoses of diabetes within a year of service can be relevant to an issue of presumptive service connection, it's irrelevant to consideration of 1151.
So on the question of whether an 1110 claim could have been reasonably raised here, as Judge Allen was pointing out, the appellant here has consistently asserted that his diabetes led to the infection that eventually led to the amputation. And at some point during the pendency of the 1151 claim, VA became aware, received information that diabetes was actually presumptively related to service. So first of all, do you know at what point VA first received that information that the appellant's condition, diabetes, had been diagnosed within 1 year of service?
Your Honor, it appears that that occurred with the June 2017. So in August 2016, appellant filed his intent to file, and then within 1 year, he filed his June 2017 formal claim. And on that claim, Your Honor, this is page 5948 of the record, the veteran identifies diabetes as well as the residuals and complications that arose from that diabetes. So after filing his 1151 claim in 2013, he actually filed the formal claim, which was not specific to 1151 and which the agency considered and adjudicated as a service connection claim. And in that one, Your Honor, that has nothing that has no indication that it was for or connected to the 1151 claim.
So the documents that were received in connection with the 1151 claim, the appellant has pointed out that the medical records that entailed the procedures leading up to the amputation actually reflect a diagnosis of diabetes with a 1996 onset. So VA, and they were VA medical records from 2011. So at least by 2013, it seems, VA was on notice that diabetes arose within a year of service. So if VA became aware of that information in the process of developing its 1151 claim, why isn't that a reasonably raised claim for diabetes under 1110?
So, Your Honor, I think, so we would make a couple of points. First would be that because the veteran specified, the context of the claim was 1151, but also the records, Your Honors, they do note diabetes, and the board acknowledged this, but those records don't relate diabetes to, they certainly don't relate diabetes to service, but they also don't relate diabetes to his amputation. So while the veteran was seeking 1151 benefits for his amputation, there's no causal connection here, as was discussed earlier, between the two. So it wouldn't put the agency on notice. And a third point, Your Honor, we would raise is that just generally the medical records can't raise an initial claim, because otherwise, Your Honors, we would, eviscerating intent that's required for claims. So because, again, we submit that this isn't related or connected to the 1151 claim per Anderson, the medical records can't constitute the raising of an initial claim here.
I want to pick up on a little bit, just flesh out sort of what you just said. So we've got two ways to victory. The first is basically that there's at least a hard barrier between 1151 claims and 1110. And the second, I think, is more about just the nature of the evidence here. I want to ask about the second. So if this were an 1110 claim, how is it different from Delisio? It seems like, right, you just mentioned the causal link, but it seems like there's a lot of similarity with Delisio, at least as to the facts, if this were an 1110 claim again.
Yeah, so,
tell me why it's different.
If we're ignoring the distinction, which I'm assuming you want me to ignore the distinction between 1110 and 1151.
Yeah, because this is your second path to victory is, in a sense, we dispense with the 1151, 1110 distinction, and now we just look into whether you know how related these. I may be misunderstanding your second point. If I am, please correct me, but I'm actually just looking at the evidence and how we can, you know, expect an adjudicator to sort of spot this.
Yeah, if we factually distinguish this case from Delisio or try to, I'm not sure that there's the causal connection between the symptoms and the disabilities or the causal condition and the initial claim condition as there was in Delisio, where the veteran had claimed symptoms or residuals of diabetes and was subsequently, you know, the agency realized that he did have diabetes in that case.
But how so? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, one way to frame his claim would be he's expressing an intent to receive compensation for an amputation. Right. And, you know, so he's got amputation below the knee. That's very common in diabetes. You know, people suffer from diabetes very often. And amputation, to me, the causal link doesn't seem that far-fetched. How you're saying that there is no causal link here. How so?
So I think, Your Honors, we would point back to the context of the claim itself. And here, Your Honor, the agency would have to extrapolate that he's diabetic and therefore he got amputation or the amputation. But the records don't support that he was amputated because of the diabetes. That was not indicated in the records that were cited in the September 2013 claim. So, you know, he said that he was amputated because VA didn't take reasonably good care of him, and he noted that he was diabetic within that context. So I think that's how we would try to distinguish the two in this case.
Could I just ask one question about that? So, and I may have this factually wrong, but he, Mr. Bonds is in receipt of service connection for below the knee amputation, right?
He is, Your Honor.
And I'm assuming that that is, I probably know this, but I can't remember it. I'm assuming that that is secondary to the diabetes, right? Isn't that the basis on which it was granted?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So then, as I understand the position, it would be, following up on Judge Toth's point, if the initial claim here had been, I seek service connection for below-the-knee amputation because it's related to service, okay? And VA goes out and does development, finds the diabetes, sees the diabetes is within 1 year of service, and then gets a medical opinion about whether the amputation is related to the knee, I mean, to the diabetes. That's Delicio right there, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the only thing I would say is that we certainly wouldn't require him to say service connection or specify to that degree. If he, for example, if he had said, oh, I'm seeking benefits for, you know, X, or if he had just identified X to a general degree without specifying or indicating that it was due to medical malpractice or VA lack of treatment, then I think the agency would have tried to clarify with him what specific benefits he's seeking.
So then, though, from your perspective, it seems to me that the Judge Toth's way of putting this, which I liked, which is there's sort of two paths to victory for the agency, right? The second path really is problematic because we know that there actually is evidence in this record that by definition had to have come to light during the 1151 claims, because that is still not final as far as we know, right? That correct. Connects the below-the-knee amputation to the diabetes. So it seems to me that the position has to be, and this is not a challenging question, I literally want to understand this, the position is the first one. It is a hard and fast rule, which is that you ask for benefits under 1151. That precludes us from looking at 1110, and that's it. That's the end. But the oddity for me is, and that's why I suggested to you earlier in my practical question, that to me, this doesn't strike me as the best factual context of making a broad rule, but the agency wants to push ahead. Because here, the issue is, oddly enough, because he said 1110, I mean, because he did more than just say, I want benefits for my below-the-knee amputation, he's being hurt because he said a little bit more. And that just seems to be a very difficult position to be in, because then the only way I think the agency prevails is because he said that a little bit more, you never look at 1110.
So yeah, I certainly understand your concern of that latter point you made there about the specificity of the claim. I think, you know, addressing that first, I think, you know, respectfully, we wouldn't say that the veteran is being, or indicate that the veteran's being penalized for that. I think it just goes back to the fact that the veteran, again, was specifically claiming this benefit or seeking benefits for 1151. And that was very apparent from, again, the claim, the context, the procedural history, things of that nature. As to the general point, Your Honor, you know, we submit that there's, excuse me, the first point is certainly the main position that we have about the distinction between 1110 and 1151. The second is more so based on the facts and looking at the fact that the intent, looking at the context of the claim. But, you know, we would simply be asking the court to affirm the general rule that already exists and about the distinction between 1110 and 1151. And I certainly understand Your Honor's concern about the oddities and, the weird fact patterns that may exist. But, you know, I think our response to that would be that the exceptions don't necessarily invalidate the rule, the general rule. So while there may be exceptions or oddities, those in and of themselves don't necessarily invalidate the general rule that exists. So I think that's kind of how we would look at it.
I want to pick up on something you mentioned earlier, because I hadn't really thought about it, which is the practical realities maybe of the type of development that a line adjudicator has to do. And so, you know, they're looking for evidence about improper treatment at a facility is very different from looking at evidence for, you know, primary service connection and nexus to service. It you got a different type of medical exam. So is there anything in the M21 about how to adjudicate 1151 claims that would be fundamentally different from how you would look into a just direct service connection claim?
I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any guidance, but if Your Honor would require that, we can certainly look into and provide that if you would need that.
No, that's all right. You mentioned it before. I wanted to follow up on that.
Yeah, I think our position, Your Honor, is just more so based on the statutes and the evidentiary requirements that they establish between 1110 and 1151. So I think that's really what we're looking at.
Okay, so that sort of segues to my final question, which is, you've sculpted your sort of entire argument around Anderson and a couple other cases. I mean, is there any statute or regulation that would preclude the agency maybe from, or maybe let's say it different, is there any positive law statute or regulations that would separate out these claims in very distinct ways and suggest that they have to be pled separately? So anything that you can point to outside of sort of how we interpreted, you know, the intent to file benefits?
Yeah. Yes, I think we would just point to 1110 and 1151 in and of themselves and essentially what they require, and then the implementing regulations as well, and them outlining the nature of the claims and essentially what the claimant would have to prove in seeking their claim.
On that point, what if Mr. Bonds had just filed the claim form that said, I'm seeking benefits for the amputation of my legs, that happened at a VA medical center, and everything else is the same. He still talks about being a diabetic and stepping on the plug and all of that. So this is sort of related. It was prompted by what Judge Toth asked. How would VA go about developing that? Would it consider it an 1110 claim only? Would it look at 1110 and 1151? Would it only look at it 1151? In other words, you see what I mean? A more general statement identifying a particular condition without the numbers, 1151, it would seem to me VA would probably develop it for both theories, right, to maximize benefits?
Conceivably, Your Honor, it would certainly depend on the context. Again, because this is such a fact-intensive inquiry, so in your
but you've got all the facts. You've got all the facts, right? Because my hypothetical is we take the claim form that he submitted in 2013. We simply excise the reference to 1151. Right? He says below the knee amputation, and he does the whole litany of I'm a diabetic. I stepped on the plug. They should have treated me better. Look at my medical records, right? Everything else is the same, except that the denomination of a statute number is missing. Would, in your view, would VA have the obligation, sympathetically reading that claim form, to explore both a direct service connection, or in this case, it would end up being secondary, but and an 1151?
I think in that situation, they probably could, Your Honor, because the lean towards 1151, it's probably less of a lean towards 1151. The only thing I would say is that even within that context, the claim would still indicate a lack of proper treatment. But that notwithstanding, I think that if a claim indicates, again, as I think I may have alluded to this somewhat, but if a claim is general enough, then the agency may ask the veteran or the claimant to clarify, or as you're indicating, to develop possibly both benefits. And that's actually why we would submit that the agency started requiring formal claims to streamline the process and to clear up any confusion and, you know, ensure that the veterans are obtaining the adjudication of the claims that they are properly speaking. So I think, you know, going back to your hypothetical, Your Honor, I think the agency possibly could have in that situation, because the push towards 1151 would be a little less.
Thanks very much. You can add anything else that you want, Mr. Youssef. I'm not cutting you off. We don't have any more questions at this point, so.
No, Your Honor, I think, you know, just generally we would submit that, you know, the court should affirm the board's decision for these reasons. And again, even, and I'm sorry, I just forgot one last point in that hypothetical. The hypothetical would, so it wouldn't be for 1110 because he's still indicating reasonable care. So if we bring in the distinction, then it would probably make it harder again. But that notwithstanding, I think that the reading a claim can vary so much from case to case. So if it's not apparent from the statement and the context that the claimant is seeking a certain benefit, then the agency is certainly required to look beyond and sympathetically read. But we just don't have that here, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you,
Your Honor. Ms. Booth, you've got your rebuttal time to the extent you need it. If you're speaking, Ms. Booth, you might still be muted.
Thank you. The significant reading rule applies to all Title 38 benefits claims, and the notion that a veteran must plead a Section 1110, and that if he pleads a different theory, he's not entitled to the benefit of the sympathetic reading rule, eviscerates that rule. It turns it on its head, because the very purpose of the rule is to account for the fact that veterans do not have, cannot be presumed to have, the knowledge of how to technically plead claims under VA law. I'd like to address just a couple of points. We continue to dispute that Anderson has anything at all to do with this case. Anderson was a jurisdictional decision. There was a claim for depression on a direct service connection theory that had been previously remanded to the agency. The veteran appealed from a board decision which, among other things, had granted 1151 claim for service connection of impotence. And for the first time on appeal, he argued the board erred by not considering secondary depression. The significance of Section 1110 and 1151 being different claims was that he had never presented his secondary claim to the agency. There was no decision, no notice of disagreement, no final board decision, therefore no CAVC jurisdiction. That's all Anderson says. It does not relate to or announce any rule regarding limitations on the scope of the claim. Number two, I think it is important to note that there is no temporal limitation on when the veteran needs to submit the additional evidence or to refine his theory of the claim, so long as the original claim remains pending. I would note that occurred in the Ingram case, where the veteran filed a 1986 claim for removal of a lung, which VA construed as pension. He filed a 1992 claim asserting an 1151 theory, also for removal of his lung. That claim was granted. The dispute was whether that reached the court was earlier effective date. Is he entitled to the 1986 effective date, or the 1992? The court held that the board erred in looking strictly to the four corners of the claim form, and that it had to consider the other evidence and the subsequent pleadings. In this case, while this claim was pending, while the 1151 claim was pending, Mr. Bonds did exactly that. He submitted the evidence of his diagnosis within 1 year, diagnosis of diabetes within 1 year, and he specifically requested a decision based on a diagnosis within 1 year. So that submission, I would contend, relates back to the 2013 claim, if indeed the 2013 claim is not limited through some artifice to the 1151 theory, which he pled. I would submit, Your Honor, that there is no theory, no basis in law by which the Secretary can accept out 1151 claims from the sympathetic reading rule. The nature of that claim, nature of that theory, as based on medical care, does not convert it into an adversarial proceeding. 1151, just like 1110, is a benefit claim under Title 38. It's entitled to be read sympathetically. The same rules apply, as if indeed the veteran had simply sought direct service connection. We would ask that the court hold that the board erred in refusing to apply and declining to apply the sympathetic reading rule to the issue of an earlier effective date for Mr. Bond's diabetes and his residuals, and ask that the court remand that issue to the board for an initial decision. If the court has no further questions, I have no further argument.
Judge.
Thank you.
Well, we want to thank the parties for their arguments today. They were helpful, very challenging case, and your good briefing. And with that, the case is submitted. Thank you.
Court is recessed.